you don't act like a real fool, whatever the case may be, something like that, then we'll allow you sometimes even more than 3 minutes. In fact, the ability could be happening, the only scientific spiritual happening anywhere in the entire universe. And joining us right now is Al Bielek. Hello, Al.
Yes.
How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm fine.
Good. Now, let's get excited. Welcome into the Billy Goodman Happening. Al, you are the gentleman who literally worked the instruments on the Philadelphia experiment. Is that correct?
Yes, the equipment in the hold, as they called it, ran the experiment.
Okay. What ship was this on?
The Eldridge.
Oh, that's it, the Eldridge.
173.
Okay. Now, there has been, I've had a lot of calls on this, on, I think Berlitz wrote a book, is that correct? Is that what I have, Berlitz?
Berlitz and Moore.
How does your story compare with Berlitz had to say?
Well, the book is written by Berlitz and Moore, which was released in 79, leaves a lot of holes and a lot of gaps because he did not have all of the information. At that time, they were still running into the same problem that I think everyone who has attempted to research the matter has run into. The Navy is not talking. They don't release files. They've kept some pictures classified for up to 25 years or more after the event when they had absolutely no connection with the Philadelphia experiment at all. And they have just sat tight on it. They deny to this day that the experiment ever happened.
They deny it, huh?
Right.
There are no records about it? How do we know about it?
There are records, but the problem is that it's actually in a category of hearsay and remembrance from people who survived it at that time, and those who have lived this long who do remember it because everybody went through a debriefing, which is another polite term for brainwashing.
We've heard that term before by
I'm sure you have.
People such as Bill Cooper.
Yes.
And things of that. Now, it has been termed the Cosmic Watergate. How does it come? Now, where does cosmic fit into this whole thing? You know, we're very much involved with the, you know, the cosmic entities and stuff of that nature. How does cosmic fit in with Philadelphia experiment? You've got to touch us.
That is rather hard to fit in as a term as such. The big problem that developed in the final and disastrous, fully disastrous test, which was 12 August 1943, was the fact that it locked up with another experiment being conducted in the period of August 1983, also the same date, 12 August, due to the fact that they were both running the same general type of equipment. Both experiments have been designed by the same person, Dr. John Neumann, and many aspects of the equipment were the same, plus another aspect, which was the so-called biorhythms of the Earth itself, which peak out every 20 years and happened to peak out on the 12th of August, 1943, 63, 83 at all. This added to it, and the whole thing locked up.
Whoa. You're listening to Al Bielek. Al, what was your rank in those days?
In those days, I was in the Navy as Lieutenant Commander.
Oh, a Lieutenant Commander. So you were a main gazinga Dorton then, as they say.
Yeah, something like that. My brother was in, he had a higher rank. He was Captain.
He was the Captain?
Yeah.
Was he the Captain of the ship?
No.
Oh. Okay, but
the ship was a Captain Engel, who was a selected captain for that experiment. He was not the captain that was used later when the ship was finally sent to sea.
Al, can I ask you to talk directly to your telephone to speak up a bit for us? It's just a little bit faint.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can hear you, but I'd appreciate it getting directly there, so more like a microphone type of sound.
Mm-hmm.
Al Bielek is in Phoenix, Arizona, and Al was the lieutenant colonel and You're the lieutenant commander. Where was the equipment?
The equipment was in the hold, so to speak. There were two large generators, which were in the hold where the normal forward gun turret and magazine would be.
Mm-hmm.
There were additional to that four large RF transmitters, which were below decks. They had a special antenna structure up on the highest point of the ship. That particular antenna structure was the design of T. Townsend Brown. And the the coils, which were driven by the generators, were on the deck of the ship. The equipment was very much similar to some of the earlier designs which were used for the degaussing work of the magnetic mines developed by the Germans about 1938. But they were similar, but not identical. The principles were nearly the same.
Did you know what the plan was right from the beginning?
No, because I didn't join it at that time. I joined the operation in 1939. I enlisted in the Navy in 1939, September. My brother also at the same time. And both of us went to what they call 90 days of special schooling at a special little location the Navy maintains in Rhode Island. We were what you would probably call 90-day wonders. We went through the school, we came out, and we were assigned to the Institute of Advanced Studies, where the project was already well underway.
Are you referring to Quonset Point?
No, no.
We used to Rhode Island.
Point.
A smaller base in Rhode Island than Quonset Point?
I'm sorry?
What base was that, by the way?
One where I went, or where it was stationed.
In Rhode Island, you said. What was the name of the base?
Oh, that was, I don't remember the name of that town now. Is there two?
Newport?
No, it was not Newport.
Uh-huh. Jamestown?
Nope.
Well, what could it be? Anyway, okay, because I'm originally from there.
I'll come up with a name.
Yeah, okay. So you were stationed in Rhode Island?
Only for 90 days.
Yeah, right. But this is where they did some special training. Did you know what they were doing or what their plan was?
No, that was not put on us at that point. You see, this was standard Navy training for officer's school.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And after we left there and went to the Institute of Advanced Studies is when we became part of the experiment. It was actually the school I'm referring to is Provincetown, Rhode Island.
Okay, that's Massachusetts. It's Providence, Rhode Island, but you may be thinking of Providence, but Provincetown.
Provincetown.
That's Massachusetts. That's out in Cape Cod. I know the area you're talking about. Anyways, the general area of the East Coast is where they do the training. We're talking with Al Bielek, and we're talking about the Philadelphia Experiment. Where did they come up with this name, the Philadelphia Experiment? Where does Philadelphia come from?
That comes from the fact that the final phases of the experiment were conducted in the harbor at Philadelphia. And that's how it got dubbed with the name Philadelphia Experiment. The actual classified government name was Project Rainbow.
Right, Project Rainbow. Oh, boy. We'll get back to more with Al Bielek, and we'll open the telephones for you in about 10 minutes or so. So if you'd like to ask Al Bielek any questions at all on the Philadelphia Experiment, our phone number is 451-5834 from out-of-state area code 702. 451-5834. My guest is Al Bielek. He is in Phoenix, Arizona. I am in Las Vegas. This is the Beligament Happening, the only scientific spiritual happening anywhere in the entire universe. Al Bielek was a lieutenant commander aboard the Eldridge. More, I guess, known in the news and people talking about it as the Philadelphia Experiment. And he was the gentleman that literally ran the equipment. Getting back to your training in Rhode Island or whatever else it was being done, when did you know that something unusual was about to take place or attempted, was going to be attempted?
We didn't know that until after the whole history of events. See, we were joined in January 1940. At that point, work was already well underway. They had a partially successful test in 1936. And in the period around 1940 sometime, they had a very successful test at Brooklyn Navy Yard involving a small ship, a tender, and two adjacent vehicles, which supplied the cable to the special equipment aboard the tender. No personnel were on board. It was a dry run, so to speak. The tender became completely invisible, so at that point, the Navy was very happy. They knew they had something that they were very desirous of having, so in September 1940, they classified the whole project.
Okay, so now, you just touched that word very quickly, and went by. It became invisible, folks. Are you ready for this? We're going back to the 40s. We're not talking about today, something, you know, really unusual. We're talking about in the 40s, they could make things invisible. How does it work? Tell us about this, Alex. This is fascinating. What did you have that made things invisible in those days?
Well, it gets into very complex theory involving mathematical concepts, which include David Hilbert's ideas of multiple space, the work done by Dr. Van Neumann. Nikola Tesla was the first director of the project.
Here we go. There's the name, Nikola Tesla, huh?
And the general idea was that based on ideas that go back into the 30s, actually 1931 with P.D. Ouspensky in his book Tertium Organum, in English that means New Model of the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
He talked then of the fact that we live in a five-dimensional reality, the three physical dimensions we know, the fourth dimension, which was time, and the fifth dimension he wasn't very clear on, is rather hazy.
Mm-hmm.
As the work was developed, and the theory was developed by these people through a period of time up into the early 40s, they recognized the fact that the fourth and fifth dimensions are time. The fourth is a linear dimension of the flow of time. The fifth is a spinner. And what they were doing or attempting to do was to provide a partial rotation of the time field in order to make the ship invisible. Radar energy would then pass straight through it without reflection, and also optical energy would pass through without being seen. They were not attempting in the initial considerations to make the ship go away, disappear to another realm, another universe, so to speak, merely a matter of optical and radar invisibility. Very complex theories were involved and some very complex hardware.
So by messing with it, they literally wound up in another universe, basically, is what I'm hearing you say. Al Bielek is my guest. Boy, this is fascinating. What did the equipment look like? Kind of describe what the equipment looked like for us.
Well, I can describe it in part, not insofar as the tender was concerned, because that was preliminary equipment, but in the Eldridge, they have two very large generators. If anyone has seen the commercial movie entitled The Philadelphia Experiment, done by EMI Thorne of England, the rendition done in there is quite accurate in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
There were two very large generators mounted vertically, not three. They did play with a third, but they had problems with it and pulled it out. It was driven by an overhead motor with two right-angle gearboxes. They were very large. They put out 75 kVA apiece. They were driven in their fields. There were five field windings for each one. They were driven by large banks of electron tubes, 6L6s, in the final design, 3,000 of them, 1,500 per generator. And preceding that was a lot of other equipment, a master pulse generator, other various types of equipment, all of which tied in not only to the generators, but also to the RF equipment, which consisted of four large RF transmitters with 2 megawatt capability. Now, Tesla's original approach, the equipment was run on a real-time analog basis, continuous, not pulsed. When Van Neumann took over in March of 42, after Tesla's test bombed out, which in case he deliberately sabotaged it,
Hold it. Stop right there. You mean Tesla had tested it, and he
built the equipment that worked in 1940.
Right, and then he wanted to bomb out?
Yes, because of the fact that he became very aware of the fact that the power required to make a large ship line invisible,
right,
be a destroyer, a cruiser, or a battleship, was very high-powered equipment, enormously powerful, and he knew there would be problems with the personnel. Reactions, violent psychological, physiological reactions.
He knew it ahead of time?
Yes.
How about that, folks? He knew it ahead of time, just like he knew about alternating current ahead of time. He was ahead of everybody every time, it seems, this man. Wow. Okay, so the equipment itself, you described it quite nicely. What did you do? Like, did you flip a switch and it activated and that was it, or?
No, there was a lot more than a switch. There were several control switches for the generators. There was what they did in the sequence of operations, the generators were brought up first and they were powered to the fields of the generators. Then they turned on the balance of the RF equipment with the pulse generators, the pulse modulators, which drove the RF equipment. That was brought on last. And then the interactive effects between the very powerful magnetic fields, pulsed fields generated by the coils, and the RF fields produced the effects that did not come on instantly. Mm-hmm. You turned the equipment on sequentially.
And what were you witnessing with your own eyes as this equipment was turning on piece by piece, so to speak?
When we were down in the hole, as my brother and myself, we did not see anything unusual at that point initially, because we were inside of a steel room, quite literally.
Right.
The effects were visible from the outside and from the observer ships and from some of the personnel who were deliberately stationed on the deck. And what they observed was some strange rotating fields, then fog. Then they couldn't see the shore or the ocean anymore. That's from inside the ship's perimeter of those fields.
Right.
Externally, in terms of the observer ships, there was more than one. There was a Navy ship. There was also a merchant marine ship, the USS Friesef.
Mm-hmm.
They were interested because of the fact that in 43, we were losing 50% of our shipping into the German submarine fleets. And they thought if we were successful, they wanted in on it also.
Sure.
What they saw externally were rotating fields, and the ship in the initial test, which was 22 July 43 on the Eldridge, they not only had radar invisibility, they had optical invisibility, but they also had severe personnel problems. The reason Tesla bombed out on this is he did not wish to be responsible for the problems with the personnel. The Navy would not give him any additional time in which to solve the problem. They said, there's a war on, you have a deadline, meet it. In other words, don't change it, make it work, typical military philosophy, if you will.
Right.
And they were under pressure.
Yeah.
Unknown to most people at that time, and unknown to myself and my brother at that time, was the Navy was in a race with the Army over the atomic bomb as to which secret project would be used in the war. As it ultimately worked out, of course, the atomic bomb project won out.
Holy mackerel. Oh, boy. Al Bielek is my guest. If you have a question for him, feel free to give us a call. You should have some fabulous questions for this gentleman. 451-5834 from out of state, area code 702-451-5834. And just before we go to the telephones, I've got to ask you this because I was reading some of the papers you sent me. It says several of the crew burst into flames in spontaneous human combustion.
Well, it was a very strange phenomenon. They burst into flames, but like the proverbial burning bush of Moses in the Bible, the bush that burned was not consumed. The same thing happened to these people, to these sailors. They were on fire, as it were, and were not consumed. It was a very, very difficult problem. The Navy spent a fortune on equipment to try and solve this problem and quell it afterwards. The apocryphal stories were, and these were the ones were circulated by Carlos Miguel Allende, who was not on board the Navy ship, but was a witness from an adjacent ship and heard the stories later, was that one of the ways they tried to kill the phenomena and bring these sailors back to normalcy was the thing of people who were still in a normal mode grabbed the hands of the sailors who were burning, as it were, starting to fade out, and this would help to bring them back to reality. Hello? Something happened to the line here. Hello?
I'm with you. I'm just answering the phones, getting some callers ready for you.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, let's go to them right now. Let's go up into Carpinteria, and there we will find Sheila.
There's Sheila right there.
Hello, Sheila.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine. How about yourself?
I'm just fine.
That's what my voice was. It's already breaking down, but I'm trying. Go ahead.
Are you sounding okay?
Okay, good.
Oh, boy. Mr. Bielek?
Yes, you're very weak. Can you talk louder?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Just about.
You have to speak up real, real strong. He's in Phoenix.
Okay. Well, I wish I was. My main question, and this is coming from a quote directly from you out of the UFO Universe article. You state that you have two identities. I'd like to know when Edward Cameron was born and when Alfred Felix was born. That's my first
question. Cameron was born in August 1916 and went through this entire sequence in the Philadelphia experiment as described, and schooling into the Navy as an officer, part of the experiment. When the experiment failed, he remained in the Navy until 1947, whereupon the Navy, or whomever, decided he was expendable, and part of the story, of course, has not been told as of tonight, but you may be familiar with it. But he was pulled up to 1983, brainwashed, completely altered, and then sent back with a complete new set of memories as Al Felix. Now, this was so thoroughly buried and so thoroughly done in terms of the brainwashing that none of the memories of this came back until about 2 years ago as to what had happened. And my brother, the same thing. It was about a little over 2 years ago when he started to remember also.
Yeah, let me touch on that a little bit, if I can, Alan. What kind of reaction did you have to this? Your mind must have been telling you things you all of a sudden you were not aware of, right?
Well, for a period of time, I was aware of things that did not fit, we'll put it that way.
Right.
That flashing memories of things which would suddenly fade out, and you have that lingering afterthought, what was it? I remembered something that's gone now.
Mm-hmm.
This went on for a long period of time. And I always had the strange feelings that I didn't quite belong with the Felix family, that I just wasn't right. There was something wrong.
Wow. Shelly, you have another question for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Another quote from you, sir. It says, you said, "You may not believe this, but secret government agencies have the ability to arrange new bodies for souls who previous physical bodies have died. My brother's soul was introduced to a body that was born in 1951, and it goes down further, for reasons I can't explain at this time, they can't allow my brother or myself to die. It was arranged that I should have the body and background of Alfred Felix, born 1927. That blows my mind.
That's taken out of the story from where?
That's from UFO Universe.
Okay, they were probably quoting from my earlier tape. I don't know which edition of the UFO Universe that is. I've not seen it.
It's the most current one. It's May of 90. It's the Brad Steiger interview with you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they do an interview with him. That's correct. Now, they do have that kind of capability, but the problem there is also it involves agencies beyond the U.S. government. And that capability has been developed in recent years. How recent, I don't know. Let us say, for example, perhaps the last 10 or 15 years, but I'm not certain when they developed that capability. But they are able to manipulate people like this to an incredible degree.
Wow.
All right, Sheila.
Well, we're just thankful we have you to tell us the story.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Al Felix is my special guest tonight, and we'll get back to him and your telephone calls right after these massages. Interesting. Brand new sponge ride was just there. It was left for me tonight like a mystery ride. Push the button, and there it was, folks. Trying to find out what company this, to tell you the truth. Anyway, back with more of your Billy Goodman happening, the only scientific spiritual happening anywhere in the entire universe. My guest is Al Felix. And Al, I just have to touch on that last question because all I could think of in my mind was reincarnation of some sort.
Yes, in essence, that's true. That was done with my brother. It was a controlled condition.
But is he your brother?
Yes. He legally is a half-brother
because
of the Cameron side connection. I am still in the original body. He is not.
I see. Okay. We are talking with Al Felix. He's the gentleman that ran the equipment aboard the Eldridge, part of the Philadelphia experiment. If you have a question for him, this is your opportunity of a lifetime to literally ask this man what took place, and there's much more to come. Don't go anywhere. Let's go out to Carlin. I think it's Carlin is where we're going right now. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's in Carlin. Are we in Carlin?
Yes, you are, dear.
How are you doing tonight?
You don't want to stay here.
No, I don't. Not at all.
Staying, continued good health, Billy.
Thank you, dear.
And for Mr. Bielix. Now, I'm a late person entirely, but I have two questions. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're a little weak, but I can hear you.
All right. I have long believed that mentally there are alternate dimensions,
yes.
That it's not another universe so much as another dimension, coexistence, and not visible normally to the five senses. Would this be the type of thing that would apply to the Eldridge? And question number two, are those people who disappeared alive, though invisible, in another coexistent dimension? And if you understand my questions, let me know, and I want to take you for about a dozen other people to hear.
Okay. Did you get the questions out?
Okay, questions.
All right, I'm going to hang up and tape. Is that all right?
Al, did you get her questions?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, G. Right. Bye-bye.
Right. The first question was about the alternate dimensions. Now, this is part of the aspect which was explored back in the 20s and so forth by David Hilbert in the so-called Hilbert space, which is the mathematical basis and derivation for multiple realities in multiple space. Now, this is all highly mathematical, but nevertheless, he was describing the possibilities of there being other realities, not another universe, as the lady said, but other realities. And also the idea of alternate realities, if you will, which is to say, we today are the result of what happened in the past, but if something else in the past had been a little bit different, today would also be different. Whatever happens today and what we experience as a reality today is a result of the past, but it also can be a little bit different than we have experienced it. Now, this gets into the realm of pure mathematics and mathematical speculation. But nonetheless, when you deal with this sort of thing, you are looking at the possibilities of alternate realities, and you're also looking with the proper hardware of the possibility of going into these alternate realities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened to the Eldridge was it dropped into a hyperspace and a hyperspace condition, which mathematically is correct and mathematically is described and has been for decades. Hilbert was, I think, the first to define it very carefully. And then, of course, there was von Neumann, there was Einstein, and there are others who have gotten into this act, if you will, in describing it and trying to build hardware to utilize these mathematical principles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other part of the question which she asked was the alternate realities or that sort of thing. I'm trying to remember exactly how she phrased that second part of the question.
Oh boy, don't do this to me. She's gone.
Okay. All of this is possible, and the idea of alternate realities is real. It is not another universe per se.
Mm-hmm.
This gets into a totally different aspect of mathematics. But this is quite possible, and these people, as she asked, what happened to them from the Eldridge? Are they living today in another reality?
Right.
The answer is, so far as I know, no. They disappeared and they died, or they went to the funny farms, those who survived.
Oh boy. Okay. Al Bielix is my guest. And now I'm honored to bring on our next caller and superstar himself, Roger Nelson. Hello, Roger.
All right, you next, Billy. Good evening to you. And Mr. Bielix, good evening to you too.
Yes.
A very, very interesting experience, obviously, you had on the Eldridge there, sir. I read the book by Berlitz and Moore a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And am glancing right now at the new copy of UFO Universe, where you explain here, to quote the article, the UFOs had been trying to warn us that we must not attempt to do the experiment on August 12th because the Earth has a particular biorhythm, and it wouldn't have been in sync with Nikola Tesla's zero-time generator. Now, I wonder if, sir, you would explain to us, for the benefit of the audience, the zero-time generator, the zero-time reference, why it was crucial for this to be perfect, to pull off the Philadelphia experiment with no negative effects, and exactly what the main problem was in doing it on August 12th with the zero-time generator and reference being out of sync.
Okay.
That's okay.
Zero-time reference generator was a device originally developed by Nikola Tesla back in the 20s. The idea and the concept is that we have a geocentric center in our galaxy to which all time is referenced. All of the planets and solar systems which are stable in their orbits are in essence locked to this zero-time reference point, and you can extract on a given planet, such as Earth, a zero-time reference tying back to that geocentric center of the universe. It is essential to have that zero-time reference in order to make certain types of electronic equipment function. That is, anything which is generating a higher order function than the normal electromagnetic, which is classed as a first level or first level wave, the first order functions in terms of electromagnetics. When you go to the second order function, you're dealing with a scalar energy, which is an electrostatic potential, and that is described by Maxwell in his equations, and is rather glossed over these days in the universities. You go to third order, fourth order, fifth order, and so forth. None of these can be generated unless you have an absolute sync to the center of the universe for the zero-time generator. Now, the zero-time generator, insofar as Tesla's design is concerned, was a mechanical device, electromechanical, which, after it was operating, locked into the Earth's field and then was locked to the zero-time reference. The reason why these other things, these higher-order realities of waves, so to speak, will not function without that is because you cannot get everything to synchronize with an ordinary crystal oscillator, because it isn't referenced to anything except itself, and the frequency will change, no matter how accurate they are. How is it that they determined that August 12th wouldn't provide this resonance? How do they measure that? They did not at that time. The August 12th was a drop-dead date assigned by the Navy. And we tried to find out why they were so adamant about this, and we never could get an adequate answer. The only thing we know is that it came from the CNO himself, and why he was concerned with this, we don't know, because he was at that time allegedly concerned with the conduct of the war and all fears of operations as far as the Navy was concerned. The zero-time reference was working. The equipment did lock to it. The problem was not with the zero-time reference. The problem was with the fact that you have two experiments going on exactly 40 years apart, at two different dates and two different eras, so to speak, both August 12th. And because of the Earth's biorhythms and the fact that they peak out every 20 years, this provided the additional impetus, if you will, the additional coupling effect, which caused the lockup. There was no lockup on the 22nd of July test. This only occurred on the 12th of August.
How's that, Roger Nelson?
Very good. One other thing, Mr. Bielek, I wanted to know, if you had perhaps, I heard you last week mentioning that you didn't know of any particular Albert Einstein involvement with the project, if I heard you right. Were you familiar with the fact that in books by David Childress, he mentions that Einstein was seen on the ship in the days before the experiment?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
That
must have been a misquote or a misunderstanding. Well, Einstein was not directly concerned with the experiment as a project which he was alone concerned with. He was concerned with all research projects at the Institute. He was concerned about that one. I do know of a story which is told in which when the changes were made between the 22nd of July and the 12th of August, because equipment was modified, that he was aboard the ship, was talking with somebody, according to the story I've heard, stating, in effect, that, quote, "These generators were designed for complete invisibility. If you change these,
you are doing something beyond the state of scientific knowledge, I will have no part of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Roger, before you go, by the way, the voice you're hearing, you can also see him now in the new Happening newsletter. Did you receive yours yet?
No, not today, but as you said, I'm hopefully expecting it tomorrow.
Well, Roger's in there, your picture's in there, along with Bill Cooper, Virgil Armstrong, Bo Greitz, Brad Kleitz, Richard Murray, Wally, Lee Samuels, and a guy who's on the radio sometimes at night here. We'll come back with more of Al Bielek, and hopefully Bill is still there. I know it's been a while, Bill, but we had those long misses of calls. Hope you can wait for it. Are you there, Bill?
Yeah, no problem.
Good boy. Okay, man.
Good to hear you back on.
Thank you, Bill.
Mr. Bielek, did you ever work with Nikola Tesla directly?
Yes, we did at that time. After I was on board in 1940, he was there until he left in March of 42. Up until the time that he retired from RCA, because he was vice president, director of all engineering worldwide from 35 to 39 at RCA in New Jersey, Camden, which is fairly convenient to the Institute. He was only there as a consultant periodically, but after he was out of that, he was there more often. I did work with him, but he did not stay on board, so to speak, on a continuous basis. He had a lot of other projects going, and he usually showed up two or three times a week.
Oh, what kind of guy was he? How did he protect himself?
Not as extensively as with Van Neumann.
Excuse me? He was just continuing. Your question was beautiful. Go back with that, Bill.
What kind of guy? How did he project himself?
How did he present himself?
Uh-huh.
Very retiring, somewhat withdrawn, but very knowledgeable. And he gave the orders as to what he wanted done, and other people did it.
Did he
not
joke or anything like that?
Cold or what?
Hold it, Bill. He's talking while you're talking.
Yes, sir.
That's okay. We can all hear him, and you'll be able to hear it. What were you saying again, Al? Finish up on that as both joking.
That he did not, Tesla did not build any equipment himself, not for a long time.
Uh-huh.
He did, of course, back in his earlier years, but in the last 10 years of his life, roughly, particularly on that project, he didn't build anything himself. He gave orders and directions as to what was to be built, and it was built either in the shops there at Princeton, that is the Institute, a very large equipment was contracted for and built outside.
All right, Bill, one more question if you like.
What kind of side effects did you have when the experiment went on afterwards?
Side effects were very powerful. It was a lasting effect on a lot of the people. Those who were below decks, shielded by the steel, did not have that much side effect, very little. Those who were on deck were the ones that had the serious problems. They were completely nauseated, disoriented, lost their time locks in the final experiment on the 12th of August. And that was the problem where they started drifting loose. It's a very complex matter. But they went quite literally insane in many cases. Those were on the decks. And the stories are also that there were two others who jumped overboard besides my brother and myself. They were never seen again.
How's that, Bill?
Wow.
Yeah, it is going to get better. It's just starting. We're just warming up for the first night back.
What's your new schedule? I don't know it anymore.
Okay, the new schedule is midnight to 2 or 3, depending on how things are going up at 2 o'clock.
Oh.
And how I'm hanging, okay?
All right.
And I hope you can stand it, man. I want you to be with me.
No problem.
Thanks a lot, Bill. All right, bye-bye.
Al Bielek is my guest. Boy, he is fascinating. You have a question for him. All our lines are tied up right now, but
feel free to call at 451-5834 from out of state, area code 702-451-5834. Let me ask you this, Al. There was Nikola Tesla, who at that time, I'm sure, was just another person in your life, in your space. You probably didn't know much about him at that point. Was there anything different about him?
Well,
they said that he had like a charisma. He was loaded with electricity, they say.
Well, I don't have any recollection of it. He was different in the sense that his attitudes, his presentation of himself was not that of an ordinary person.
Uh-huh. However, he was, of course, very erudite. He was not highly educated in the normal sense of the word, that is, of having a lot of schooling in back of him, because he went to 1 year of college and had to drop out because his father died in 1879.
Uh-huh.
And he did not have a formal degree as such, though he was given an honorary doctorate later in the U.S. But he was not ignorant of what was going on. He was highly intuitive.
I can see Crystal and Cressly right now. She was telling me some stories about, she was 6 years old, and her dream was, at 6 years old, mind you, Al, her dream was to go to the planetarium and play with a Tesla coil.
Mm.
At 6 years old, are you right? That was her, when she was a young child.
Who was this?
A gal who listens to us right now in Crestline, California. Her name is Crystal. She was telling me how enthralled she was with this man, Nikola Tesla. And I can see her beaming right now as she listened to the happening tonight. Al Billick is my guest, and Billy in Ontario is sitting there. I can see her right now. Look at the smile on her face. It's your turn, Billy.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
So happy to have you back. Hello, Mr. Billy.
I can almost hear you.
You have to speak up, Billy, baby.
All right.
That's fine.
This is the most incredible story. I heard about it in the 60s, and I always wanted to know more about it. You mentioned that some of the men were embedded in the hall.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, there were two embedded in the steel deck and two in the steel bulkhead. When they lost their time locks, their time references, and the ship had the equipment smashed so that it came back to normal space and time, they were floating, so to speak, without reference. The ship had its own reference, which was still functioning. But the individual has what could be called a set of time locks on the normal stream of time or the flow, so that you are locked to that point from conception on, and you flow with the normal time flow, and you're a part of the reality that everybody knows. And of course, you wake up the next morning, you know the same people, you're in the same time frame, your things flow in a normal manner, which everybody accepts. But if those time locks are broken loose for any reason, and that's what happened to a number of people on the Eldridge as a result of the very high-powered magnetic equipment, the pulsing magnetic fields, if they're locked loose, they're knocked loose from their normal locks, as long as they are within the confined field of the Eldridge as it was when it was on, they didn't float away, they didn't go away, but when the fields went down, that is after the equipment was shut off and destroyed in part, wherever they happened to be when they re-manifested in terms of physical reality in our normal three-dimensional frame of reference, if they were not in the same physical location that they had been in reference to the ship, when the ship rematerialized and then they rematerialized, they could be anywheres. And what happened in four of the cases there, they happened to be in the wrong place when the ship rematerialized and the steel deck or steel wall materialized, and they happened to be in the same location, and suddenly the molecular structure of the steel was locked into the molecular structure of their body.
Oh my, I can visualize it, but boy, it was too painful. Oh, not only that, but you can see how it could happen.
A painful way to die.
I guess. How's that, Billy?
I can visualize it, but boy, it must be painful. Oh, not only that, but I can even, you can see how it could happen.
A painful way to die.
Yes. How's that, Billy?
That was just incredible. You know, John Lear mentioned that we were companions when we had him on. And I'm just wondering if sometime you might get John Lear and maybe Bill Cooper and Mr. What was the name again?
Bielik?
Yeah. Bielik.
Yeah.
Mr. Bielik on together on a, on a hookup. And it would be a really fantastic privilege to be able to listen to the exchange.
Right.
And one other thing I'd like to say to all the listeners who love you so much, Billy, I think we all ought to send little postcards in saying how much we love you and how glad we are to have you back, and stay well.
Well, thank you very much for the
and
call.
I look forward to reading. What was the name of your book again, Mr. Bielik?
The name of your book, Al?
Don't know yet when it will be out. Hopefully late spring. And it will be done in connection with Brad Steiger. We're supposed to start on it finally near the end of this week and next week. And it will be first an update of some work which Brad had done previously. The title is not exactly firm yet, but it will, as soon as it is, I can let you know on that.
All right, Billy.
We'll be waiting for it.
The lady who called in, she mentioned the fact that she had heard of the Philadelphia experiment in the 60s.
Yeah.
Can she say where she heard of it?
Where did you hear about it, Billy?
I have a precocious friend named Marvin, and he was the one, he was the reader of Tesla, and I was excited about Tesla back then, too, and he told me about the experiment, and where Marvin got the information, I don't know. I can find out.
Hmm. All right. Okay. Thank you, Billy.
God bless.
All right. Bye-bye. Interesting question, Laura. You know, good audience. Are you in a hurry at all?
No, I'm not.
Oh, you sound very relaxed. Pleasure to have you on board. Stick around and get back to your phone calls and more with Al Bielik. We have one line open for you, and that's the brand new member line at 702-451-5655. We'll get back to more of your telephone calls and your questions for my guest tonight, Al Bielik, and more of your Bielik Event happening after these messages. Diva George. George is standing by. I know George always got some great questions. Hi, George.
Good evening, gentlemen. Al, can you hear me?
Al, can you hear him?
You're a little weak.
Yeah.
Al, can you give us some details about the 1983 experiment? And also, what was being attempted at that time? And what were the end results? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
First of all, before you go, George, did you get the question, boy?
He was referring to 1983.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And what was going on there?
Mm-hmm.
This was a project which had been ongoing for a number of years, actually from the 60s, so-called Phoenix Project. It is still, it is no longer in operation, but nevertheless it is still considered a classified project. I can only give you some minimum detail on that. The operation was in the original location at Montauk, Long Island, unlike the movie which put it in Wendover, Utah, in the old air base, which it was not. The other terminal was in Long Island at Montauk Point, which is the extreme eastern tip of Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
The equipment was similar but more powerful and updated, involving modern computers like the IBM 360 and some other specialized computers. And the purpose of that was manifold, but one of the final things they did was the capability of time travel and doing it any place, any time. It was because of the nature of the equipment and the fact they also used a zero time reference and the fact that both sets of equipments, if you will, were designed in essence by the same man, Dr. John von Neumann. The approaches were similar, the fields were generated were similar, though mathematically they were not identical. But they locked up because of that strange effect of the Earth and the 20-year intervals. the purpose was not the same as with the Eldridge and with the original invisibility experiment. They had no intent to create anything invisible. That was not the purpose at all of the Phoenix End. It's merely the fact that the equipments were similar and the dates were propitious, the thing locked up. Now, does that answer the gentleman's question, I hope?
I think very thoroughly. You're certainly a very concise man, isn't it, folks? Al Bielek is my guest. He is in Phoenix. I am here in Las Vegas. It was the Bielek event happening, the only scientific spiritual happening anywhere in the entire universe. And we are about to go out, or actually down to San Diego. And there's Francis. Hello, Francis.
Hello.
Oh, yes. Speak up, please.
All right. I heard you speak, Mr. Bielek, in San Diego. You said at that time that Tesla didn't have the solution to the personnel problem. Can you tell us who and how you gained the knowledge or the solution to that?
The solution to that was worked out by Dr. Van Neumann. Now, after the experiment, the Philadelphia experiment that collapsed in 43, he was transferred to Los Alamos, New Mexico, to work on the atomic bomb project, along with Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, Vannevar Bush, and a few other people. And that project was complete, and the war was over. In 1947, after some major changes in the Defense Department establishment, he was reapproached and asked if he would reopen the matter of the Philadelphia experiment and see if he could find out what really went wrong and whether there was anything salvageable from that. Without going into a lot of the other side issues here, along about 1949, he had some insights into the problem. He spent over 2 years on it. And of course, he was involved in some other things at the same time, but he decided that he had to go back and do his basic homework in metaphysics. And if you can imagine a man who was a hard-headed mathematician and a physicist suddenly confronted with things like the human psyche and what goes on in terms of metaphysics and having to do his homework in this area, probably, in my view, was, and I was not around there anymore, but in my view, it was probably rather nauseous to him at first. In any case, he found the basic problem was the time locks or the time references of the individuals were not referenced to the ship's reference. He had to develop a system to lock the individual time references for each individual on board the ship to the ship's zero time generator reference and see that they remained locked and were not ripped loose. This required a whole new approach. He had to develop a computer. And, of course, he is the father of the modern electronic computer, which he worked on at the Institute roughly from about 1949 through 51, had a working model about 51, 52. And after not knowing myself the details of how it was solved in terms of the actual hardware, it was solved. In 53, they did have a successful test with another ship. The Eldridge was long gone. It was in the Greek Navy by then. And they had no personnel problems. It was solved. And then the project name was changed. Project Rainbow was dropped, and it became called Project Phoenix. There was many aspects to Project Phoenix, other than the one I described. That basically was the nature of the problem. You had to find a way to reference the individual's time locks and the time reference points to the ship so that no matter which way the ship went, where it went, whatever happened to it, each individual was referenced to the ship's reference and remained locked to that reference. So when the fields were turned off, the individuals are where they belonged and where they had been.
Does that answer your question, Francis?
I understand there was a space reference there somewhere.
I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you.
I understood earlier that there was a spaceship reference or something.
No reference. There were, in the last days before the final test, there were three UFOs sitting over the Eldridge. At what height, I don't know. I don't recall having seen them myself, but they were seen. And they had no part in the experiment per se, but they were observing. And the stories that we got since then, not at that time, but the inference was at that time, perhaps they were trying to warn us. Since then, we've learned that they may well have been trying to warn us not to proceed with the experiment. But this, again, is conjecture at this point. In any case, they were there at the time of the final test and experiment. One of them disappeared. One of the ships was pulled into hyperspace along with the Eldridge.
Oh, boy. How's that, Francis?
Fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, what do you think?
I thought it was the most fantastic evening.
I can't hear you at all.
I thought the evening listening to you talk in San Diego was just fantastic.
Are you talking about my separate talk at the time when I was down on Cooper's platform?
Yes.
The latter?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the call, Francis.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Al Bielek is my guest. We have a line open for you at 451-5834 from out of state. Of course, that's area code 702-451-5834. In the meantime, we'll check out and see what's on Bernadette's mind tonight. Bernadette, I'm sure, has something to ask Mr. Bielek. Hello, Bernadette.
Hello, Mr. Bielek.
Yes.
The information the lady talked about a few minutes ago that came from the 1960s, it may have come from a book called, I think it was called The Case for the UFO by Jessup, and may have been annotated by Allende or something. Anyway, that book, I believe I read it way back in either in the early 70s or the late 60s. And it had information on the Philadelphia experiment.
Book which,
also, do you have any tapes out or reports written by you that we can order? And I have one more question after that.
I'm barely catching what you're saying. You're a little weak.
Okay. Do you have any tapes out or reports that you have written that we can order through the mail?
On the Philadelphia experiment?
Yes.
No, I do not as yet have anything written. It's only in the form of the notes I have for the lecture room, the videotapes that have been made.
Okay. And then I had one more question. You mentioned technology from the experiment, which came from beyond the military. Did it have to do with private scientists coming up with this information, or could it have come from aliens? And if so, do you know at around what date the government or military had first contact with aliens? Was it prior to 1947? If you have any knowledge of this.
There's an interesting story told about this. In 1975, this is part of the research done by William Moore for the book The Philadelphia Experiment, Berlitz and Moore, which was released in 1979. He heard some stories. He was chasing down UFO stories, among other things. And he heard the stories about a UFO incident up in Canada, and I believe in Ontario province. He went up to visit these people in 1975 or early 76, and a very interesting story developed out of that. This Canadian farmer was on his way home one night when he was buzzed by a UFO, and then the next thing you know, this thing was sitting in the roadway, blocking his path, and apparently nobody in it. This occurred on October 7th, 1975, a man by the name of Robert Suffren. And later, he turned around to leave, and seems like the UFOnaut was sitting in the road, and he almost ran him down. Well, about 2 months later, shows up a team of top military personnel, one from the Canadian government, one from the United States Air Force and the Pentagon, and one from the Office of Naval Research, or Naval Intelligence, I believe, in this case. And they said they had been sent to the Suffren family to apologize for the incident that occurred. It wasn't supposed to happen. Do you have any questions? This may have been one of the few times in history where the government opened up. But in the course of a long question and answer session, it seems like one of the Naval Intelligence officer came up with a commentary. Says, oh, we have known about ET since 1943. At the time when the Navy was doing an experiment in radar invisibility that went wrong, he says we knew all about them at that time.
Oh, Peter.
Yeah, right. I like that. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
All right, Rick. Well, that was big. That's big news because that's been brought up before more than once here on the happening, but it seems to be the only records that we have, even going back to above top secret. That the first sighting was not until 1947, but now you're telling us there was contact back in the earlier 40s.
43, right.
Okay. Al Bielek is my guest, and if you're out there listening to us outside the state of Nevada and you've never called us before, we have a line open for you. It's called our new member line. That's 702-451-5655. I want to remind you that if you'd like a copy of what you're hearing tonight, because you can't remember everything, audio cassettes are available if you call Roger the Dodger, and he is available right now, not only for tonight's happening, but any of the preceding happenings. If you have any questions on any of the preceding happenings or tonight, you call Roger the Dodger at 702-564-4404. 702-564-4404. Where are we going? How about going down to San Bernardino and talking with Bud? Did you say Bud Halderman?
Yeah.
For some reason, that name rings a bell to me. I don't know why.
Well, I call you on occasion.
No, but not only that, there's another reason for that, sir. Something about a gate.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, Bud.
Mr. Bieler.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Earlier in your presentation, you were discussing the fact that a person would be put into another person's body, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you made the comment that the U.S. government was doing this, and then you stated that somebody above the U.S. government was involved in it. Would you expand on that, please?
Yes. The technology that was developed for the Phoenix Project, which is essentially where this occurred, was a joint project between private individuals who was under surveillance by the U.S. government intelligence agencies. It was not involved with the military as a funded project. But nonetheless, most of the research, there was at least 10 years worth of it, involved ETs who were working along with the personnel on the station in terms of certain of the mathematical equations and conversion of their data into a format which would be accepted by the IBM 360, which was the best computer we had at that time. I'm talking about the period in the mid-70s. A lot of the data involved concepts which apparently were alien, which were unknown to us at that time. And this data comes not as a Paco Field story, but this comes from the man who was the top project director during the latter phases of this project, that he was told when he took over that he had to learn to work with ETs, that they were putting part and parcel of the project. Now it appears that, and all of the data indicates that these ETs have a much more thorough and complete knowledge of the human psyche, the human soul, and the entire mechanism of life, if you will, than we do. And are consequently are able to manipulate it almost any way they want. Whether it is done because of what they want to do, whether it's done in cooperation with the government, it's hard to say. But I'm certain that it was not a one-sided thing. This has occurred, and of course the idea of a walk-in is not new. That is well known in metaphysical literature, and has been well known for decades, for centuries.
Yeah.
But the fact that it could be done on demand is another story, and this involves technology which is probably still beyond our comprehension.
How about that, Bud?
Well, that's fine. Another question. Do you have any knowledge about the government in their research into time travel?
I have some, yes. I'm certainly not thorough on it. The Phoenix Project involved that of itself.
Okay, you kind of answered one of my questions about what you think about UFOs and extraterrestrials, and apparently you think they exist.
No question.
Okay.
How's that, buddy? Thanks for the call, bud.
I'd like to ask one quick one. Mr. Bielek, are you familiar with the Urantia book?
No, I am not. I've heard the title, but I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. Well, I sure appreciate you. It's the most interesting discussion tonight.
Right.
I wish you well.
Thank you. Thank you, bud.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Al Bielek is the gentleman that he's referring to as being interesting, and he sure is interesting. Now, this Philadelphia experiment making a ship literally disappear, did they ever use that equipment for anything else that you're aware of?
Excuse me, did they?
Yes.
Well, after the project was successfully completed in 1953, I can say yes, it was. That approach has been expanded and has been used since in a number of areas, but that becomes extremely sensitive.
That's why I asked the question. I have heard, and I want to hear from your lips and from others, I guess. Can you give us any inkling at all when you say it becomes sensitive? Why are you saying it's so sensitive, by the way, if everything else you've been talking about is not so sensitive?
Well, has to be explained is the fact that the classification level on that type of thing is at least top secret, if not beyond, and it involves hardware and approaches which are currently in use.
Does it also involve with extra technology from the extraterrestrial area?
No, this is Earth-born, Earth-bred technology.
Oh, okay. All right. And then I was reaching out for something else that I had heard. I guess it's untrue. Al Bielek is my guest. We have a question for him. It's 451-5834. Come out of state area code 702-451-5834. If you've never called before, 702-451-5655. We'll get you through to the Billy Goodman happening, and we'll get back to your phone calls and more with Al Bielek. As a matter of fact, Draco in Riverside is up next.
Back with more as we go down to Riverside, and if all goes well, Draco is still there. He hasn't fallen asleep.
Hello, Draco.
Hey, Billy.
How are you doing?
I'm still with you. Hanging in here.
All right, buddy. All right.
The hours have been changed.
Yes, they have.
I want to ask you, if you thought you ever considered the possibility of space time travel without mechanical devices.
Yes, that's,
I can hardly hear you.
You're not too strong either. Yes, that actually was a consideration and was one of the techniques that we're working on at the Phoenix Project.
Could you hear him at all?
I can't barely hear
you. You are pretty much before, like you were earlier, so you have to get right into it, really come out of the diaphragm, because you are calling from Phoenix and he's in Riverside and I'm in Las Vegas. You figure we have to get back and forth each other a little better.
Okay, what I said was that the gentleman there's statement or question, has this ever been considered? Yes, it has been, and it was one of the techniques developed by the Phoenix Project.
Where did you get that, Draco?
Yes, it was interesting, in my own way, I started on the Phoenix Project through automatic writing, and I went onto the global and followed up my intuition on this in this area, and I talked to Mr. Van Trassel, and when I encountered him, I approached him to ask him a question about pyramids and space-time travel and things, and immediately I started knowing. And like Nikola Tesla, what had happened, I had learned that I entered into what is called Venusian consciousness. And in that state of consciousness, you instantaneously know the answer to your own questions.
Yep.
And answer is given in such simple, not simple ways, it's hard for people on Earth to understand the importance of the answers. And after a period of time, I followed his method that he was describing, and I contacted the Brotherhood of the Seven Rays, the Monastery of the Seven Rays, and Master Aquarius. He's called the Master Aquarius because he's already transcended this age, and he's working on the age of Capricorn. And in his teachings that I followed, some of the teachings were that the Master of the space-time continuum. Can you hear me, Billy?
Yeah, sure, yeah, we got you.
And basically, what I had come to know and is that we're living in a continuum, a space-time continuum. It's going at this constant we call the speed of light. And along parallel to the space-time continuum is electromagnetic continuum. In other words, the electromagnetic biochemical continuum, which is the manifestation of the elements about it. And in a meditation, he said it, because he said, I think therefore I am. If you can fluctuate, you can find a way to fluctuate the electromagnetic continuum that you move in your own body, therefore you can change the relationship to space and time. Does that sound simple enough?
Well,
can you hear me?
He heard you, and Draco, thanks for the call. Let him respond. Okay, guys?
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
All right.
There have been stories like this and considerations that individuals, if they really have, as part of the expression, have their heads together and their abilities together, may be able to travel in time without hardware or equipment of any type. And I've heard these stories, I've heard this consideration. I personally know of no examples. The only way I know of it can be done is with hardware, and of course it is very complex, so the theoretical considerations are not as complex as perhaps the hardware used to implement it. But yes, insofar as doing it mentally is concerned, I think one could say anything is possible, but that doesn't mean everybody can do it.
Nothing surprises you, Harald.
I'm sorry?
Nothing surprises you anymore, I'm sure.
No.
I mean, after going through what you went through, I mean, you saw something that probably, obviously a small percentage in the world even knows about, because they won't even admit it, and you went ahead and said, when I asked you the question, which was kind of a catchy question, I wanted to hear it from you, that they used this very same equipment again, and they still are today, and they're still denying it. It's almost like the UFO thing. It goes right back to the very same thing.
In many respects, that's true. The complete denials of the UFO business, one, of course, the government itself has been very heavily involved in recovering UFOs and research. I'm sure you know the stories of Area 51 and all that goes on there.
Oh, do we ever? We were there.
I know. I've seen your tape.
Oh, have you?
That's just only one example of the cover-up. This goes on and on. Cover-ups in many areas.
But I mean, this particular one, if I'm hearing you correctly, and I want everybody to tune in because I know that they know where I'm going with this, because we've talked about it before. Here they had something, we're going into the 40s. So I'm going to assume that they've been using this for 50 years. Almost 50 years. Would you agree with me? In different ways, wherever they wanted to use it. If it served their purpose.
Not quite as long as that.
Why? If it started in the 40s, it was available for 50 years, obviously.
Available in the sense that they knew the basic technology, yes.
Well, when did the Philadelphia experiment happen?
1943.
Okay, so then that tells me that they had this equipment effective in 43, which is almost 50 years,
mm-hmm.
that they could have done heard it before, and I can't think of it. Nikola Tesla was the one who invented it. It's probably the very same thing. That what it may even be able to, what you're talking about, could affect the weather. Is that correct? I know you don't want to talk about it, but are we getting into that?
Some of the very high power will affect the weather.
Of course it will. I'm hearing it. I mean, I won't be a bit surprised if they're not using it this week. But I'm serious. You know what's going on the East Coast? It was 86 degrees in New York today.
I know. It's 40 hotter in New York than it is here.
40 degrees. Count them.
Yeah.
Not 4 degrees above normal. 40 degrees above normal. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
And I got a funny feeling I'm messing around with this equipment. Okay. Al Bielek is my guest, and it's exciting. I mean, can you go to 3 o'clock quickly tonight?
I think I probably.
All right. We'll go all the way, folks. I'm going to let you do that. What I'm going to do is around the 2 o'clock hour,
okay.
I'm going to take about a 10 to 15 minute break.
Right.
Because we're going to put on the Von Gürtgen Report. By the way, folks, you don't want to miss this Von Gürtgen Report tonight. And you don't want to miss it either, Al. I mean, he's going to be talking about some real heavy-duty stuff. Not quite what you're into, or we're into at one time, but I mean, this is what's going on today. And we just touched on something that I think is so important. When you analyze it, we have had this technology for over 40 years in our hands, and who knows in whose hands by now. It's probably all over the world by now. Wouldn't you agree? Come on.
Not necessarily.
Oh, come on. You don't think we shared it with our buddies, the Soviet Union, by now?
Oh, I'm sure.
You know it as well as I do. You better believe it. Okay, Al, let's go to, let's see, who's standing by for you? Oh, Laurie in Van Nuys. This is not to be confused with Natalie in Van Nuys, right? No, this is another. Natalie is probably Natalie's neighbor. Hello, Laurie.
Hi, Mr. Bielek. I have a question about time travel.
You have to speak up. I can't just about hear you myself, Laurie. Please, yell at him.
Okay. I have a question about the time travel. I'm not sure what you mean about time travel. I'm not understanding your concept. I mean, if you travel to somewhere like 2010, are there people going to be there in the future?
Maybe.
Good, Al. I think you really have to repeat the question.
In other words, obviously, she's really, really brand new on this. She's talking about time travel, and her question, which is a very good one.
Yeah.
She's thinking, well, if you can time travel, can you go like to 2010, and there'll be people there in that year?
Yes.
How's that, Lord?
I didn't do that, but nevertheless, that capability was there, and according to these stories we've heard about the Phoenix Project, they travel much further than that into the future.
Al Bielek is my guest. We'll get back to him and your
telephone call. Steve Salter is standing by. But first, let's go to the buffet.
You're really good and happening as we're going to go for 3 o'clock this morning. We'll be here until 3 o'clock or until they come and take me away.
Whichever comes first. Time and space. Wouldn't that be a wild thing to do, though? I think I'd like to do that one time before I check out. Wouldn't you like to do that, Al? Obviously, have you done it, Al? Be honest.
Of course.
Okay. How about describing? In other words, here you are at one time, and then soon thereafter you in another time. Do you know the difference?
Not immediately.
I didn't think you would. Yeah, I can picture that. How do you know it is different?
Well, in the case of what happened there, when we left the ship in 43, we jumped overboard and thought we would wind up in the harbor, away from everything that was going crazy.
Yeah.
We didn't wind up in the harbor, we wound up standing on dry ground at Mount Clark in 1983.
I love it. Now, you're telling me you're diving off a large ship, and you wind up standing on a harbor.
We wind up standing on earth ground, not in the harbor.
Okay, I mean standing on earth. Wow. At
1983 at Montauk. We didn't know what happened.
Well,
the military police came and took us down below into the underground area of the labs, and then we eventually found out what had happened.
Okay. One more massage. And we'll
Hi, Billy. Excellent show tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Billick, how are you tonight?
Fine.
For a real simple man, a lot of this electronic stuff is way over my head, but am I to understand that this is basically electronic camouflage?
The original intent with the photograph experiment was that. It was electronic camouflage, if you will, but a little bit more than that. The intent was to make the initial experiment, the ship, invisible both to light or visual observation as well as radar. The second attempt, which was the really disastrous one, they only intended to have radar invisibility. You can call it camouflage, if you will, because in the second one, it was still visible through a haze, but it disappeared off the radar screen. You can call it, in a certain sense, you can call it camouflage. It's more complex than that. It's not a matter of covering the ship with something. It's a very complex phenomenon.
Is this something that the UFO spacecraft could also be using today?
Oh, yeah, you're not out of here.
Undoubtedly, yes, probably so. But some of these visitors are far more advanced than we are.
So, by all means, we probably inherited a lot of this technology from the ETs.
In the case of the Philadelphia experiment, that was not the case. It was all born and bred here. Some of the things that have happened since is another matter.
That's outstanding. For a simple mind here, am I supposed to understand now what they did was they got the frequency of the ship's metal, and when they discovered what the frequency was, then the ship disappeared?
Not the frequency of the metal, no. It's a matter of space-time, actually time rotation and creating a warp, a minor one, so to speak, such that the RF energy from the radar beam would pass right on through the ship and not be reflected. If you have no reflection, you have no return, you have no image. That basically was what they were trying to do there. That's what basically they did.
Well, I've got to believe that we're quite advanced. Billy, you're right. They've been doing experiments for the last 50 years.
Steve, before you go, I should tell us about your event coming up.
Well, okay. On April 9th, which is a Monday evening, at Clark County Community College, we're going to have a real learning experience. We're going to have some familiar names coming out to speak. First of all, we'll have your host of tonight, Billy Goodman, come. Interesting. Very interesting.
now that they know that they can do, that they can make things invisible or whatever the heck they're doing with this thing.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of that? There's a book written by Dean Koontz called Lightning, and it had to do with time travel and how we go back in time to change events, to change things into the future. Has that got anything to do with what they're doing with it now? And if it isn't, they are doing that. Are they aware of the ethics involved in paradox?
I'm quite sure they're aware of it. That is some of the considerations which have come up since the 70s. And there are many stories about this sort of thing as to time travel being a reality and so forth. I've heard many stories on it, and I know perhaps a little bit more about it than I want to say on the air, but yeah, you do have the problem of a paradox, as you call it. If you attempt to go back into the past and change an event that has already occurred, it doesn't occur that you change everything afterwards. You have that possibility of changing the future by changing the past. And you can alter what we have accepted and what we know as reality now by making some major change in the past.
Mm-hmm. And the thick plottings, that's a term I use.
Thick plottings, right.
That is true. But you can use that if you'd like, Al.
Okay.
The thick plottings, boy, as we keep on going. Al Bielek, unbelievable stuff. And we're going to try to get you here in Las Vegas somewhere down the line. Got to get you out here so people can meet you and sit around and talk with you and really get into this. Is there anything that you feel uncomfortable talking about over the airwaves that you would talk probably more freely in person about?
There are some areas I would talk more freely in person.
Okay. You feel a little bit intimidated by the airwaves then. I don't know why we only go all over the world. The tapes go all over the world. You must know that. Huh?
I say one doesn't always know how far these things may go off the airwaves.
Believe me, the cassettes go all over the world. Trust what I tell you. I got a call from Dr. Henry. Dr. Henry, the other day from Nottingham, England, who had audio cassettes and wanted more and more information on, you know, what's going on over here. And he told me that there's a radio station in England that plays some of the tapes, and he heard the announcers react in such a way that they couldn't believe, and they had played the Bob Lazar interview. Have you heard that?
No, I've not heard it on tape, but I've seen the TV version.
Oh, boy, I tell you, it just flabbergasted them. They said they took a few phone calls. He was telling me all about it, and people just were basically like that gal and Lori and Van. I say, what? Really? This is really going on under our noses? And no one told us about it. Huh? All right. Al Bielek is my guest, and he's going to stay with us until 3 o'clock. Now, Al, here's what I suggest you do. If you'd like, put the phone down. I'm going to turn the pot down anyway.
Yeah.
Go relax. Come back in about, we'll check back, because the phone will still be, I'll keep it live, so you can look at the phone, you hear the radio station, hear me talking, you'll know it's your turn to come back. We're going to have a Von Gerken report. I will tune into that quick. Pick up the phone, listen to it. I think you'll find it fascinating. I'll talk to you in about 10 minutes.
All right.
All right, let's do this, you know, it's called ID time.
Phone calls and who knows what else as we head for 3 o'clock on this year.
Compared to the cloaking device that we often see in the Star Trek series, would you like to comment on this?
Well, the Star Trek series is very interesting in itself. One sometimes wonders where the ideas of some of these science fiction shows really come from. What do they come from somebody knowing something about what has gone before, or whether it is sheer speculation which happens to coincide with something that's already been done is hard to say. But it's probably not the same, but the concept could well be the same. The idea is the same, namely to make a ship invisible, however you do it. Of course, putting the thing off several hundred years in the future, as the Star Trek series is, anything can be done. But the idea is very similar.
How's that, of course?
That's very intriguing. I'm wondering if H.G. Wells is listening in from wherever he may be, you know? He came up with the concept of the time machine.
Thank you. A Voice in the Wind. By the way, A Voice in the Wind has one of her poems in the new Billy Goodman Happy newsletter called Celestial Dreams.
There'll be some more poems
submitted. Oh, really?
Okay. All right.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. A lot going in the month's Billy Goodman Happy newsletter. By the way, are you on the mailing list, Al Bielek?
No, I'm not.
Oh, boy. Shame on you. You're going to be Al Bielek is my guest. He's in Phoenix. This is Billy Goodman in Las Vegas. This is Billy Goodman happening. The only scientific spiritual happening anywhere in the entire universe. Al Bielek literally ran equipment, if you're just tuning us in for the first time, ran equipment that made a ship disappear. You probably heard about it, called the Philadelphia Experiment. And it has finally been revealed right here in the Billy Goodman happening that this equipment we're talking about has been available to not only, I guess, anybody now, for the past over 40 years. But it's been hidden. How can they keep these hidden so long, Al?
I'm sorry, how can they?
How can they keep it hidden so long?
I would put it this way easily. If you have the power of a government to cover up throughout the escape, to suppress the news media as they often do, but in this case, they don't even really have to suppress much of anything. All they have to do is keep the basic data and information from getting into public hands, brainwash all the people that took part in it, then the story dies.
Oh, boy. Now, you are a lieutenant commander. You took an oath. You believed everything that what you were doing. And not only you, but others that have been members now, Colonel Bo Greitch and Bill Cooper, and Virgil Armstrong. They had you in the service, but for some reason or other, they lost you guys. How did they lose you? I mean, what made you different than the other GIs? Is, hey, okay, whatever you say goes.
I presume it comes down very simply to the fact that you realize that there has been a great injustice done
here,
not only to yourself, but to a lot of other people in my case, and I realize that the way they mistreated, covered up, did not mistreat everybody, but
right.
Those who survived. They were mistreated in the sense that they never had any medical compensation, they never had any disability,
mm-hmm.
And their lives were ruined.
Yeah. I mean, and you saw your buddies murdered. I mean, that's your right down to the nitty gritty. You don't want to use the word murder, but that's what happened.
Well, in a certain sense, one could say that.
Yeah.
He died under very strange circumstances.
Well, I'm talking about the guys on the ship.
Yes. Yeah.
Tesla said there was going to be a problem. Don't mess with it. Right?
Right.
And they still went ahead, did it knowing full well that there was a problem. And I think that you said earlier in the show.
Yeah, they knew there was a problem, but they didn't want to deal with it. They wanted to keep this project going and hope that it would come out all right, because the Navy, you must also remember that a very strong Navy man at that time was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president.
I was waiting for this. The strongest Navy man who wanted the bomb himself, right?
Yeah, he wanted this project to go, and
right.
I don't know whether he was in favor of the bomb project or not. Nevertheless, he favored the Navy.
Right.
And one could speculate again. Suppose this project had succeeded in the way that was anticipated.
Yeah, right.
Then the funding would have gone to it, and the bomb would have been set aside. Probably not forever, but it would be set aside, and then most of the funding would have gone to the Navy. So it turns out that the Navy project was a disaster. All of the funding was then switched to the atomic bomb project.
Okay, well, I'm reaching out a little bit, but I really have to kind of compare the two. I don't know if they correlate, but I wanted, they knew that they could be jeopardizing lives, but they wanted to go forward with it because this was their plan, correct?
Wanted to go forward with it because it was somebody's favorite project.
Okay. Could that be the same situation that happened, and I know you weren't there, but could it be the very same situation that happened with our space shuttle and the Challenger?
In a manner of speaking, perhaps yes. There is not a direct comparison, but in the case of the Challenger, it is interesting to note that that particular morning there were engineers from Fayacola who warned NASA do not go ahead with the test.
That's right.
Hold, you will have problems, and NASA reversed themselves from the normal procedure, which was if anybody questions the safety of a launch, they will not launch until everybody agrees it is safe.
I'm glad you told that. That's the first time, too, is it not in history they reversed it?
That's right.
I don't know that, folks. It's the first time they ever reversed that policy. Al Billick is my guest, and boy, we are opening a channel. What's the word you use here? I like this. Let the chips fall where they may, right?
Right.
Okay, Al Billick is my guest, and Super Tech is out there.
Is that you making that noise, Super Tech?
Not me. Good morning, Billy. Good morning, Al. Can you hear me, Al?
Yes, I can.
Okay. You know, for the last 8 months, I've been telling Billy about a system that I first became aware of. In 1975, I was sitting in my development engineering lab with Burroughs Memrick in Silicon Valley, and I was delivered by the mail deliverer my new IEEE magazine, which is the International Electrical Engineering magazine.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Which even Nikola Tesla was a member of.
Yes,
well, anyway, it was about an article that in 1976, Jimmy Carter, authorized the sale of huge magnetic systems to the Russians that they were going to install up in, Siberia, for climatic weather control, and our American electromagnetic engineers installed the system. Billy, what have I been telling you all along?
Well, this is quite true. I'm familiar with that story. And it is a fact. Your largest electromagnetic coils ever built were built in the U.S. and shipped to Russia. That is true.
Right. Where have you seen 30 degrees in Florida with icicles hanging off the oranges? Down in Southern California, 29 degrees, icicles hanging off of the orange groves. And Al, I got to ask you something. Something's been happening through the years that nobody pays attention to. People that instantly burst on fire standing on a corner in the middle of the street or something. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I've heard of these cases, and some of them are well documented.
Yes, they are. Yes, they're well documented. And as far as Nikola Tesla, if you remember, lightning in his hand in the late 1880s, he transported several hundred thousand volts, a bolt of lightning, 75 miles with no transmission lines, Al. Are you familiar with that one?
Not the distance like that, but I know that in 1999 and 1900, when he was in his Colorado Springs lab, he generated lightning bolts over 200 feet long, and nobody's ever been able to duplicate it to this day.
Well, this one was done back in between New Jersey and Philadelphia, somewhere, or whatever it was. But I've read it in my book I have. This man here also came up with another theory that he was using was to use his AC generators, alternating current, which is 360 cycles per second. You know, he got four quadrants of 90 degrees. That's phasing.
Yeah.
He used underwater pipes as conduits and used the earth for ground to transport high potential. The man was a brilliant, brilliant man.
Yes, he was.
I classify him into this as a scientist, not an engineer.
Very true. He was both.
Okay, and as far as the IBM that you mentioned, I had one in my lab. Was called an IBM 370, 155 VS, back in 1973, that I was using. But really, I could take systems in the background, all types
mode.
Yes, it is.
All right, Super Tech. You know, well, you had all your notes, didn't you?
Oh, it's all in my head. Don't forget, I got a computer between my ears and the back of my eyes.
Okay, Super Tech.
Take care, buddy.
Bye-bye. Well, you had everything you said earlier tonight, didn't you? He had you down pretty well, didn't he, Al? Al?
Yes.
He had you down pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty good. Okay, Al Bielek, the most exciting person at times, is out there. He is, like, telling us everything you've ever wanted to know about the Philadelphia experiment. He was there. Matter of fact, he ran the equipment. Familiar with Ron Arrow? You heard his name before?
Am I familiar with what?
Ron Arrow. His name, Ron Arrow?
No.
He says that there are definitely weather wars going on right now. And they call it the coldest war. Have you heard that term before?
Not in those words. But the weather war, yes. There have been other people that have talked about this over the years, for at least the last 2 years. Colonel Bearden, Thomas E. Bearden, has been on this for years.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, the reason I bring this up, Al, is Ron Arrow. My guest will get back to him and your telephone calls. As a matter of fact, we'll be going down to a beautiful downtown Burbank, the home of Piglet, right after this.
Go to Burbank, as promised, and see if Mike has a phone with you in Piglet.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
How are you
doing? I have a couple of questions. Number one, I wanted to find out if anybody has heard about...
Mike, we can just about hear you. You got to speak up, buddy.
Okay. I would like to know if your guest has any information on a similar experiment that was supposedly done in the Seattle area, in the Puget Sound area.
Okay, did you hear it?
The similar experiment was supposed to have been done where?
In the Seattle area, Puget Sound area.
Oh. You mean that's similar to the Philadelphia experiment?
Right, yes.
No, I have no knowledge of that.
Okay, the other question is, in trying to recall all this information about what happened to you, have you used hypnosis or any other modality?
No, hypnosis has been used. It's a matter of the memories coming back, because no matter what brainwashing technique is used, unless you have a periodic refresh, so to speak, of what you are to forget, eventually you, if you pardon the expression, forget the instructions, and eventually the memories will come back as long as the brain is intact. And this is what has happened. And in this case, the stimulus was a viewing in early 88 of the Philadelphia Experiment movie, which I had never seen before. I saw it on HBO TV one night. And it was after that it started to come back.
When's the next time you're going to be in the California area?
When's the next time you're going to be in the L.A. area, he was asking?
Do not know. Possibly fairly soon, but no, I say that in perhaps the next 30 days.
I guarantee after this happening tonight, you're going to have all kinds of offers to go all over the West Coast. I can guarantee
it.
Okay, thank you for calling. Hey, Mike.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone to Piglet?
No.
You know where it is?
No.
It's on Olive.
Oh, okay.
Check it out sometime. Go in there and say hello to Joyce.
Okay.
And tell her that you listen to Billy G. And that Billy doesn't happen. Will you do that?
Okay.
Introduce yourself to her, okay?
I'd like
to find it. You find it. Olive. It's easy to find.
Okay.
All right. So it's right across from the studios. Take care, guy. Bye-bye.
All right. I want to remind you that if you'd like a copy of what you're hearing tonight, your own audio cassette copy, anything you've heard tonight, or for that matter, anything that's been, really been happening in the past, you call Roger the Dodger right now at 702-564-4404. At 702-564-4404. And while you're doing that, we'll go over and talk with Gentle Ben and see what's on Gentle Ben's mind. Hello, Gentle Ben.
Howdy.
How you doing?
Yeah. I was curious, to what extent are you aware of the technical details being well documented anywhere that is accessible? The technical details? They are not accessible
the Navy still has files on this. I know this for a fact without going into how I know it. I have not had my hands on them, but that information is not accessible. It is still classified as far as I can determine, even though the 40-year law, which says any government and military secret, in quotes, or operation more than 40 years old is automatically declassified. Those files are not available. Now, whether or not they can be spun on freedom of information, I do not know. I have not tried that as yet.
That's a good approach. We should try that. That's a good approach, gentlemen. You should try that. You might be able to do something with that.
In terms of his actual activity there as far as these two generator-like units, were they hooked in parallel, or was there just one generator unit per coil? And you mentioned something about five windings and five phases.
Generator.
Was it one coil per phase, or just what was the basic configuration of that aspect?
The basic configuration of the five excitation windings was very peculiar. One could perhaps draw an analogy and say they were approximately 72 degrees apart, but they're not, this is not that simple. The drive system on this is very complex. The outputs from the two generators were paralleled, actually one generator ran two coils, another generator ran the other two sets of coils, and they had to be in absolute sync. There was electronic means for synchronizing the two generators because of the amount of power being used both to drive the generators from a very large motor in the gearbox, which is a little bit sloppy with that amount of power being driven. The two generators had to be electrically synchronized. They had to be in exact sync so that the fields that were generated were in sync. It was a complex system, and that's only part of it.
Yeah, with respect to the coil fields, were they basically just creating a, were they oriented perpendicular to the earth, and were they sequencing perpendicular to the earth?
So the generators were mounted with their shafts vertical, so they were perpendicular to the parallel to the axis of the earth. They were perpendicular to the surface.
Yeah, I was thinking of the magnetic coils on the ship.
Oh, the coils themselves? The coils themselves were mounted on the deck in the final arrangement. And the fields that were generated from those would be parallel to the surface of the earth. It's a very complex setup that they had, that the coils were mounted. The coils were not round, they were conical. Tesla loved to build conical transformers and conical coil windings where they tapered like a funnel. And the large end of that taper would be down towards the surface of the deck, and the smaller end of that taper would be pointed upward. The axis of the coil would be vertical. How's that?
Thank you, gentlemen. That's what I was thinking on that. Could you, when I hang up, could you touch on the RF orientation and the relationship? And as far as the coil, what the phasing was, loosely speaking, of the coils, and if it was basically the same phasing difference you described on the generators, to say so.
Of the magnetically driven coils?
Yes.
Okay, the magnetically driven coils, which came off the generator, generated a huge magnetic field, and it was pulsed. And all of the frequencies, interestingly enough, derived from a mathematical series, which is basically pi over 2. Now, the RF fields were also pulsed, but it was a modulation that was pulsed. And they all had to be synchronized through some functions, which were mathematically derived. I don't even remember all of the equations on that. But nonetheless, the end effect was a rotating time field.
How's that, gentlemen? Did you get all your questions?
Oh, okay, so it was a rotating time field. Was it important whether it was a clockwise or counterclockwise field?
That's a good question. In terms of the Coriolis effect and the other interactions on the surface of the earth, in the northern hemisphere being one direction, the southern the other, the opposite.
I remember correctly, they were counterclockwise.
Okay. If you could just clarify the polarization and maybe just roughly the relationship in terms of if there was a frequency multiple at all for the RF field, and then I'll just hang up and pick up the last of your answers.
I couldn't catch all of what you said there. Could you repeat it?
Oh, on the RF emitter, on the RF antenna,
yeah.
As far as the field lobe emission orientation of those, and if there was a frequency multiple relationship to the generator magnetic field, could you describe that briefly?
Yes, there was a frequency multiple involved, and the RF fields were in the four transmitters in the final version was on a single mast with a multiple antenna setup, which was at the highest point on the ship. The fields interacted, and the RF fields were essentially flat. It was radiated horizontally, somewhat from crest.
Omnidirectional horizontal.
They were essentially at the horizontal field. The end effect was that it generated an open-ended field, very much like the mathematical images of the black hole. You had a narrow neck and you had an expansion out both sides. That was one form that could have used for the generation of the field. The other form, which they did not use and would have been better if they had, would be the closed field oblate spheroid. It's more complex to, much more difficult to implement that type of field. So they took the easy way out.
Especially back then.
I'm sorry?
Especially back then.
Yeah. They didn't expect there would be anything else that could interfere. There was no concept at that time of somebody else doing something else in the future that could lock into them.
Okay. On one other side, and this is in the space, I'm surprised. Well, okay, you came across the recognition of the virtual space relationship of each being relative to the time-space index. Something I ran across was that in terms of the virtual event situations where you were concerned about where somebody goes back and they alter something and then they come back.
Yeah.
What I seem to experience with that, but I haven't really pinned it down in great detail, was that it's from the point of view of the person that did go back and come back, that was an apparent event, whereas for the people he left behind, they continued on their experience or on their timeline, if you will. And the person coming back actually comes back to another timeline. But there's a similar parallel there with the difference being whatever the effect was that he did back then. And it's in a kind of a space situation where there's an infinite number of timelines, and it gets really strange, but it's inappropriate to go into it much past what I just mentioned, I think.
It does get very strange when an individual goes into the past and comes back. They do not come back to the exact point of specific time, the instant where they left. They have to displace slightly, which is an answer saying yes, they do come back to a timeline which is slightly displaced. It's essentially in the same time frame, but it can be displaced by milliseconds or half a second or whatever, depending how fine they want. They can cut it with equipment. But they do not come back to the exact same point.
Oh, gentlemen, I let you go about 15 minutes here. It's been fascinating.
Okay.
I mean, the questions were great. I just hope everybody out there appreciated it. What do you do, gentlemen? Are you in science or something?
I'm unemployed and hiding in a little frightened hole.
What?
I'm unemployed and just hiding out in a little apartment. I've been wanting to get into science again, but I've just been too hard up about the way people are using it.
What can you do with a young man like him? He's got
what? Something interesting, Billy.
What?
The other day, I was just started going over some thoughts about the time space, and then a whole bunch of pages came through that blew my mind loose about all this stuff, and I can't really relate it to. Maybe I can talk to Hawkins or somebody.
unbelievable stuff. I enjoyed your questions, and I think everybody enjoyed the exchange between the two of you. And didn't this man answer every single one of your questions? I mean, he had every answer ready for you.
Oh, he did very well in terms of keeping it within an appropriate limit for this audience.
Oh, boy. All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you for being there. And, you know, I'd love to see something be in place in case anything funny does happen in the future. I was a little bit scared when you were disappearing for those 2 days.
What do you suggest we can do so that someone knows everything? I don't know how else to do it. The station
well,
should announce.
One aspect is to just have, like, the focal point, what's his name that does the tapes and stuff.
Roger the Dodger.
And as far as being able to contact him for an alternative,
or Gerald Ben, the newsletter officer, is also a very good place, too. And I've given everybody my personal number. You have my personal number, don't you?
And then the... Yes, and then there was one other aspect that struck me, too.
What's that?
You know, in terms of manipulation, when you have the corporation status and whatnot, you can indirectly do some very subtle manipulation. For example, who brought up the idea for them to go and check out at the mall to see what the popularity of the station was and the direction to go and all that. Indirectly, that could have been a manipulation.
Oh, I know it was. I don't even know what you're talking about, to tell you the truth. At the malls. We talk about at the malls, by the way.
Well, as far as when the census is what probably taken, you know.
What census? What are you talking about?
Oh, when they take the census to find out what the station should be doing to get the public opinion poll.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, sometimes when they get a public opinion poll, whether the station is...
You think they did what they did because of a public opinion poll?
No, well... No, hang on,
okay.
Billy.
All right.
It's possible that they may have been put up to doing an opinion poll with the full knowledge. In other words, it could have been very subtle, or they could have been directly almost threatened, okay? But it could be either way. So what I'm saying is, from the point of view of the immediate people in the station, it could have been a much more subtle thing to where it didn't necessarily stand out that much, but it's different little factors like that. Sometimes it can be so subtle when you can influence the people that actually buy the advertising time, too.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no problem on this happening, as far as I know. Well, it never was, but anyway, thanks for the call.
Okay, well, thank you for being there, and thank you, Al, for being there.
Okay. Bye-bye. Al Bunick is my guest, and we'll get back to your telephone calls. You have one more massage.
I just want to say I appreciate so much you staying on so long. It must be rather strange for you going over this stuff. But I wanted to ask you, are you familiar with Stuart Edward White's book, The Unobstructed Universe?
Yes.
Could you tell me, do some of those experiments that they did confirm the concept of time as receptivity and space as conductivity?
Yes, can you want to say? Done by Stuart White.
Yes.
It's been a long time since I wrote that book. And
then White came through the medium and gave the dissertation on the actual physics.
Yeah.
And describing that we're all in the same universe, but that we're in the obstructed because of matter and they're in the obstructed on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And she mentioned how space and time are considered differently, that time is considered receptivity and space conductivity. And I found a lot of difficulty in understanding the concept. I really use this all the time. Would that confirm anything in those books? What you've done?
Not that I can recall at this point.
I can hardly hear you.
I tell you, not that I can recall at this point.
I see. But you are familiar with the book.
I am familiar with the title. I did read it, but it was many, many years ago.
Yeah, it's a very old book. All right, get away from that. Now, you said that you jumped overboard during the Cape Health experiment in 1943.
Yes.
And you came up on dry ground at Montauk Point in 1983?
That's correct.
This is mind-boggling. I mean, to me,
yes, it was to us, too.
By nature, it was. Can I ask you, I mean, what is the condition of your body?
Well, there's no change due to that.
I mean, are you still have the body of 1943, or has it aged?
Oh, when you go that quickly through 43.
I can hardly hear you.
There's no aging because of that transit, because it's like taking a piece of paper, maybe theoretically it's a mile long, and you take the two ends and you put them close together, etc.
circumvent all of those in between. And in essence, you have made an instantaneous transfer.
I can hardly hear you, Mr. Buehler.
I say you make, in essence, an instantaneous transfer in terms of the time. Therefore, there is no aging any more than the actual time involved in the transfer, which is perhaps less than a minute. Basically, much less. It's hard to measure it as such. There's no standard by which you can measure, but it's a very short period of time. You do not age because of the fact that you jumped 40 years, because you didn't take 40 years to make the jump like you do a normal time flow. It's done almost instantaneously.
So is your body 40 years older, or are you younger than you would be normally?
Neither. But that's true.
Neither?
The body does not change its actual physical age at all because of that transit.
Oh, it doesn't change physical, I see what you're saying. I mean, I don't really understand that, but I swear
Who does?
But
you know what? If you recall when Bob Lazar was on here, he said the very same thing about gravity, like how you folded it, and you go, and the spaceship went from one, like from here all the way up to the other universe in no time at all.
Right.
Exactly. I can hear it. It's all the same thing. Time warp and time travel and everything else.
Right. He's working on anti-gravity too. Who? Dr. Wright.
Right. Okay.
Wrong.
Right. Hopefully.
Exactly. I can hear it. It's all the same thing. Time warp and time travel and everything else.
Right. He's working on anti-gravity too.
Who?
Dr. Wright.
Right. Okay. Wrong. Right. How's it right? Who's right? I'm right.
And Mr. Buehler, also, can you, if this is not too disturbing to go over again, you mentioned something about your soul or your brother's soul being replaced?
Not his soul being replaced. He died in 83, and he was transferred back to another body from the same father.
I see.
Was born in 51 and he was a walking in 63.
I understand. Okay. I guess I understand. I've heard of walking.
Right.
All right. There was one more thing I wanted to ask you. Has the Navy ever done, or have you heard of any experiments like Tesla tried to do, I believe, or Edison to contact people who have died? Have they ever come up with a machine?
As far as the Navy is concerned, not that I know of.
I heard it. Edison or Tesla that was trying to work, and I can't remember which one.
You're not listening to him, Desiree.
I'm sorry, I can't hear him.
Well, settle down. It'd be okay. Just settle down. Go ahead. Figure it out.
I say, as far as I know, the Navy has not engaged in any type of research like that. They're still a little too hard-headed to get involved in the metaphysics.
I love that line. All right, Desiree.
Okay, can I ask one more question? I did wait a long time.
Okay, go ahead.
When you said that there was a lockup on the 1983 experiment,
yeah.
So there actually was there any time travel involved, or did just the whole experiment fall apart?
Well, the ship went into hyperspace, and eventually it returned, and was returned to its own normal time and location. The only travel involved was the two of us who jumped overboard and wound up in 83, and then we were sent back later to shut off the equipment by smashing it with axes in order to shut off the other end of that thing where the energy was on at both ends and had created the hyperspace bubble. So that, in order to collapse that, one or both sources had to be shut off. Now they could shut the one off in the 83 end, but they couldn't shut the one off down in hyperspace. We had to be sent back there in order to shut the equipment off by chopping up with axes.
Okay, Desiree.
Okay, well, thank you. I look forward to your book version, Jack.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Desiree.
Thank
all
you,
right.
Jay. Bye-bye.
All right, let's go quickly to John, and John's going to be the lucky man, the last caller. Hello, John.
Hi, Billy.
Hi.
Great program tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Al?
Yeah.
Did you hear of anything in the 30s? There was supposed to be either one individual or two individuals making a nightclub act, and
helmet that made him invisible, or a cabinet that you could reach into and feel him and made him invisible?
Yes. That was actually written up with photographs. One of the popular scientific type magazines at that time allegedly took place at an English fair in London in 1935 or 36. And I remember seeing that issue, and the photos are in there indicating the gradual loss of visibility. The body faded out from the toes on up to the head, and then when the equipment was turned off, they slowly reappeared in reverse order. But the person could reach in, they could talk with the individual, and they could reach in and feel that the person was physically there, but they were quite invisible. Yes, this did allegedly occur in the period around 1935-36 in England.
Oh, interesting story that one was. Wow.
Okay. Did you notice, or had any of the people in the experiment notice whether there was any change of consciousness in the aspect of capacity or enlargement in a positive way in the experiment?
That would be hard to answer insofar as anyone else was concerned. But insofar as my brother and myself were concerned, we had no interest whatever in metaphysics prior to the experiment. And afterwards, there was a great deal of expanding interest in this direction. It took time, but it was there. And the same happened to Van Neumann. He was a hard-headed mathematician and physicist, but after he found out what the problem was and the facts were, he had to do his homework in metaphysics, and he became very much involved in those areas at a later time. He also became a very strong believer in UFOs for the simple reason he was on three recovery projects in 47, 48, and 49 in New Mexico.
Wow. And the six plot moves even your door.
I have one last question. Yeah. While you're in the Navy, did you know of or do you know about using the serial numbers, your dog tag numbers, for putting people into different brackets of intellectual ability or capability?
Using a serial number as assigned by the Navy then to indicate the person's IQ or mental capacity? I did not know of any such system being used, no.
Well, I didn't know of it, but I had an unusual number at the time, and I was wondering if there was a purpose behind it. Thank you very much, both of you, for the program tonight.
John, thanks for the call.
And I'll sign off.
All right, guys. Bye-bye.
I'll be there.
We've done 3 hours, and it seems like 5 minutes, with so much information, and I just know the phones are still ringing, and I know everybody who wanted to talk to you did not get an opportunity to do so. Can we do this again in a week's time? Would you like to do it again in a week's time?
Possibly so.
Okay.
We'll have to assign a date.
Well, I'm going to assign it right now so we can tell the world everybody out there listening so they can put it down on their calendar. How about if we do it a week from tonight, 7 days, or 7 nights, whatever you want to call it, 7 nights from tonight.
Okay.
That's Wednesday, actually going into Thursday morning, on the 20th, 21st that is, on the 21st going into the 22nd. The same thing, call me from Phoenix. I mean, I know they love this, and I loved it, and I know after they've heard you, they probably were writing down questions they didn't have a chance to answer. I mean, you are fantastic, sir. You answer every question. Not only do you answer the question, but you add more to it. It's just so well done. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you.
Okay.
I mean that sincerely. And I look forward to next Wednesday going into Thursday morning. And we'll be talking about it between now and then, because I know you just brought up a topic. And I have a funny feeling. And, you know, we are the UFO Connection on the West Coast, and we are the Nikola Tesla, I guess, supporters all over the world now, and very much involved with the Trilateral Commission on Urantia. I have a funny feeling the Philadelphia Experiment is going to be a major topic in the 90s. I mean, we talked about some things tonight, and I know we have, like, newspapers that listen to us, and they write stories, and many of the UFO networks, and I know this is going to go all over the world. This is going to open up things that people aren't even aware of.
what you wanted to do.
I'm sure what you're saying is correct, because as an example, the book done by Barbara Shimore and the experiment sold over 10 million copies.
Wow!
And paperback, of course.
Now, what year was this when that book came out?
1979.
And all of a sudden, it was quieted down. I mean, what happened to all of the national networks? How come they didn't get involved with this story?
I do not know.
I know why. I can tell you why. But okay, it's not going to be the same way this time around. We did not have the tabloid television, quote unquote, like we have today.
That's probably.
We didn't have the investigative reporters as we do today. But now we have them. And I know they're hungry for something like this. Once again, Al, I want to thank you very much. I look forward to next Wednesday evening with you, same time, same station, as they say. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with? Anything that we can prepare ourselves with, or anything you want us to know about you, or something you have going that we should know about?
The only thing I can add at this point is that there will be a book coming out, and it will be a joint effort between Brad Steiger and myself on the first one.
Yeah.
That will hopefully be finished in the middle before this month is out.
Great.
And after that, there are various videotapes available of my various talks. The one out of Dallas, MUFON, in January is available. There's also one from the Sedona talk last Saturday night, which is being handled directly by the person who did the taping. And if anyone wants to get a copy of that, I can give you the information on that.
Sure.
On the phone, it's Gem Graphics Incorporated, PO Box 2131, Sedona, Arizona, 86336.
Al, may I suggest this instead of giving that out? Why don't you give out the box office you gave me for yourself? So the
PO Box is 44932.
This is Al Felix now, 44932.
Phoenix, Arizona, 85064.
The reason I said it would be easier if they called me at the office and they didn't get it all. I can pass that along, and at least that way you will get the communication. You can pass it on down the line. How that sounds.
Right.
So once again, I look forward to next Wednesday night.
Okay. I'll be back in touch with you before then.
Okay, good. Thank you, Al.
Okay.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Good night.
Wasn't that a very exciting happening? I can see the smile on your face. Wow, Billy gets back. And the happening happens like it's never happened before. Wasn't that a strong one? Right at the beginning, Ron Arrows is standing by in the next couple of days. We'll be talking about the weather wars and who knows what else. That's going to do it for the Philly Goodman happening. Before I forget, let me remind you now, we do have a new mailing address. Send all of your mail now to this new mailing address, the Philly Goodman happening, 860 East Twain, building number 128, suite 450, Las Vegas, Nevada, 89109. Well, I hope my voice is not breaking up again and I have to go through what I went through the past 5 days. That would be no fun, and will be not fun for anybody else either for that matter, but I mean, oh, I hurt a little bit. Anyway, what else? Oh, and the phone number. For the Billy Goodman Happening office, jot this down so you can have it for your files. Area code 702-792-3611. This is one more thing. If you'd like a copy of tonight's happening, or for that matter, any of the preceding Billy Goodman happenings, feel free to call Roger the Dodger at 702-564-4404. And I guess that's the way. It brings it up to date, does it not? I believe it does. For our first night back together. Tell your friends we're now on After Midnight or the Midnight Caller. I didn't say that. Just pulling it up. But and don't forget, next Wednesday, seven nights from tonight, you'll be able to get your questions in if you didn't get in. And I can get in before the others again, I guess. There is a particular question because A, you don't have a telephone, you're working, you don't have access to a telephone at that hour, whatever the case may be, feel free to Rut Day coming up and Horizon Fall. A bunch of other stuff. What else is there? The big event over at Clark County Community College coming up on the 9th of April.